which was just operating at the temperature of ambient space. Okay, probably now an iconic figure is out there that was released last July, showing all sky with cosmic microwave background. It's a mosaic from all of the frequencies Planck, with the cosmic microwave background made sufficiently obscure so that you couldn't Fourier transform it and do science with it, and conveniently covered by these beautiful veils, which didn't have to be quite as big as they are. It's all a question of what color scheme you use to hide what will ultimately be coming and what most people in this room are probably most interested in. But trying to strip away those veils is a topic of extreme importance to get at what underlies it. And the physics of the veils is actually absolutely fascinating, which I hope you will agree with. There was a major release in Paris on January the 11th, accompanying a meeting called Planck 2011 from the 10th to the 14th. And for my sins, because Sinyaev was sick, I had to do the summary. Now, the summary, and this is basically associated with that summary. The difficulty with giving a summary is that you have to attend all of the talks. You have to actually try and understand all of the talks. And the difficulty with Planck is that it is a vast enterprise with, oh, I don't know, 700 or so scientists on it. Of the 25 papers, there are about 200 authors on each of the papers. So it's very sweeping, very daunting to be able to have pithy things to say about all of the areas. So I decided not to be pithy. Well, anyway, no, I'm going to try and give you an indication of some of these things. First off, looking at issues associated with the satellite itself. There it was when it was actually in Kourou before the launch, being checked out. This is the focal plane with HFI here. These are horns looking like this on the side that focus the radiation that go to bolometers, which are here, the very cool, ultra-cool things. And then these bigger horns around it are associated with the low-frequency instrument, a consequence of the sort of bigger horn aspect. The telescope and the dependence upon frequency is that the beams associated with these low-frequency detections are, the beam size is quite a bit bigger than you get with the high-frequency instrument, which is where the major big effect is going to be. So I was very pleased that the sensitivity to Canada within the Planck collaboration, in spite of the fact that we're relatively small players relative to the Europe, of course, in the U.S., but that we were explicitly noted in the unveiling of the results with lots of logos, including the Canadian Space Agency and some Toronto-based efforts. CETA's here somewhere, University of Toronto, and somewhere UBC exists. Well, anyway, UBC. Okay, so I thought just, oh, by the way, I should also say, Marc Antoine gave the astronomy colloquium a short while ago where he discussed the first results from Planck, but with obvious emphasis on the interstellar medium. So I am going to say some things about the interstellar medium, but my emphasis will be more on other things. But he showed something akin to this, and I thought it would be worthwhile for those of you who don't know. Toronto is actually a hotbed of Planckian activity. I've been involved in this since 1993, essentially since the conception. We got Canada involved since about 2000-2001, and we started a series of contracts in order to deliver some Canadian goods to justify us being in the consortium. The Toronto group is associated with the high frequency instrument. The UBC group is associated with the low frequency instrument. And so there are a series of people who are engaged at Toronto in CSA Planck HFI, and then a group in basically around UBC, but there are people elsewhere associated with the Planck HFI that are in Canada. What do we care about? Well, for me, what might not surprise you is that the primary thing is the primary CMB. In particular, obviously, we're interested in cosmic parameters, the gravity waves, the non-Gaussianity, subdominant elements like small isocurvature, cosmic strings, anomalies. Maybe they're going to tell us something as we dig deeper and deeper into the data. As well, we have strong interest in galaxy clusters as one of the big byproducts of Planck. But we are also a major hotbed of activity in the ISM, all aspects of it. Marc Antoine, Peter Martin, others. One of the things that is of great interest to us is the joining together of Planck with other instruments. Herschel has gotten some great results, as you'll see a bit of that. ACT and Planck, perfect combination. As we saw today, the lever arm of Planck plus ACT pole when it's in place, SPT pole is huge because of the ability to go out so far in L. ABS is a B-mode trying to go for the gravity wave component. SPIDER is too. And there are other activities in Canada that are associated with that kind of science. I won't go through this very much. It's just that we've done a lot of duty here. Marc Antoine has been often taking and ingesting the data in Paris. One of the things that we were responsible for in Canada was something that gets sent to ESA, which is the daily quality report on how all of the detectors are working on the HFI, and a weekly health report as well. Okay, there's been lots of work on trying to understand the instrument. That's really the name of the game in microwave background work. And Marc Antoine leads the Galactic Planck Sky Model, which is sort of a grand unified vision that will be informed heavily by the Planck data. So what was released were 25 papers. That was for 10 months of data, all nine frequency channels, temperature data only, no polarization. There was a press conference, which was quite fun to attend. The first and most important thing to take away is HFI and LFI are working flawlessly. This is the most remarkable thing because it's at L2, and if anything went wrong, we were in a disastrous situation, and yet it's all great. As I will show you a bit more, there was the early release compact source catalog with about 15,000 sources. They are the things that pick up or stand out enormously within the Planck data, and the idea was that you would do this quick look at the Planck data and try and find these enormous things, give the information to the community so that they could do follow-up and see what these things are. There was also a Sunyaev Zeldovich catalog associated with this using somewhat different methods, as we'll see, that delivered about 190 clusters seen in the Sunyaev Zeldovich. But there was also information on the cosmic infrared background. The dusty Milky Way, many, many other things. Most of the science was enabled because of the huge frequency coverage that Planck has, nine frequencies from short wavelengths of millimeter through to the long wavelength radio. The next release of papers is probably going to be February 2012, in which there's going to be a next big meeting in Bologna. That will not include cosmology. Cosmology at the moment is scheduled for a January 2013 release. That is an important date because we have to get the first data products out from Planck for the community to use. Now the issue is, and I don't know the answer to this, and I don't think anybody does, will it just be two surveys, which was what was required for the delivery, or will it be more than that? Unclear. The expectation is that there will be another big thing around December 2014 or so associated with a very in-depth analysis, because some of the things that we will be finding for Planck hopefully require incredible precision, and it takes a long time to make sure that everything is understood systematically at the level that we need. The B mode of polarization is an example.
But how much data will go into that map, those maps, is another question. That's a requirement. Tell me when I'm not saying something that's absolutely correct here,
but that's the dates that we think is going. Okay, performance is great. Anybody who's done forecasting for your favorite model of cosmology, you've probably gone to what's called the Planck Blue Book, which was made actually a number of years ago, and it was saying this is what we would like to be at. It was better than the minimal mission, and it was reasonably ambitious, and HFI and LFI are essentially a little bit better than that. And that's in orbit with all of the stuff that could have gone wrong. So that's the sort of major take-home message from what I'm saying here. And there are a few points along the way which I don't want to overemphasize here because they are sort of for aficionados, but it's an amazing path that got us to here because there were some things that were not expected in the data. Probably the biggest thing that wasn't expected was the large number of cosmic rays that were hitting. And it turned out to be a bit of an anomaly associated with the launch time. It turned out that the sun was very, very low in its activity, which means that its magnetic field wasn't large enough to get rid of a lot of the low-energy cosmic rays. And so there is on the detectors, and remember, they're ultra-sensitive detectors, and it's L2, so there's no Earth magnetic field having a role here. So they're getting hit, and these bolometers at less than 100 millikelvin are incredibly sensitive detectors for cosmic rays. But you didn't want them to be, but they are, and there's no way you can avoid that. And the curious thing that happened, here is a glitch rate and essentially a more or less a monitor for how heavy the cosmic ray hits are. And you can see that as time has gone on, it's dropped, not a huge amount, but it did drop, showing that we were in this anomalous period. Okay. Then there is another issue which was considered to be unfortunate, and now Marc Antoine and others are going to turn it into a virtue, which is that it turned out that the 100 gigahertz channel, which has got a certain width, and the 220 gigahertz channel, which has got a certain width, happened to have a carbon monoxide line in them, which means that the detectors are picking up carbon monoxide emission in the galaxy, and that could be a problem because that's not cosmology. So that one has to use the information to try and do a further separation of components than we thought that would have to be done in order to try and separate out the CO. So the virtue of this, for those who play the ISM game, is that it may deliver the best all-sky CO map ever done by a large margin. Okay, the LFI, low-frequency instrument, whoop.
We didn't know this before, that CO line is going to fall in.
That was an oversight. So the 100 gigahertz was pretty much a last-minute thing. Originally, the 100 gigahertz was going to be part of the LFI, and it was going to use HEMS. And then there was a funding fiasco with the Italians, and the U.S. was thinking of picking it up. Actually, I was in charge of helping to figure out if this is the thing to do. And in the end, the decision was the bolometers are more sensitive. Let's go for 100 gigahertz bolometers. And so then everything was sort of done quickly there, and it's got a better polarization capability, and it will be even more. We can deal with this. It will be probably fairly clean in the end. So this will not be so much the rate limiting step. The resolution there is about, 9 minutes or so. With 150 gigahertz, which is a better channel for cosmology, it's about 7 arc minutes. And then as you go to 20, you get down to about 5, and it stays 4.5 as you go out. So in other words, in terms of resolution, the higher frequencies the better. Okay, the LFI also essentially a little bit better than Blue Book and beams understood. And just to put this into context, and here is a context, LFI, here's WMAP, I dropped it off with 9 years in terms of sensitivity as a function of L, which I've also dropped off. And this is 4 sky surveys of LFI. And so you can see, I think that's 500 or 600 there. It does win, and it will win over all of the years of WMAP, and it is they're quite nice in terms of it. But the better take-home number is the HFI sensitivity in terms of a curious unit, microkelvin degree, of what one can get to with the 4 sky surveys. The take-home number is that in sensitivity, it's about 1,000 years of WMAP. So not WMAP 9, but WMAP 1,000. And very, very important is the factor of 2 and more smaller beam. Okay, so I've talked about that first part. Now, with Planck, especially if you're going for these foregrounds and sources and all of that, you want it to be X'd, just like there was a WMAP X'd, for those of you who know about it, and those of us who were part of X'd were a bit annoyed by the audacity of WMAP to call us such. But X'd is extremely important, the exterior data that is coming in to add to what you can learn from Planck. And what we heard about at the meeting was fundamental importance for XMM Newton, Herschel, Fermi of all things, total interplay, very interesting, synchrotron. WMAP, of course, the Green Bank Telescope played an extremely important role at the meeting. BLAST, which has got this great Canadian aspect to it. ACT, SPT, AMI, which is a British CMB experiment looking for Sinyaya Zeldovich, the cosmic background image, or some other things as we go down the list. And so that was all in play. The theme of the meeting was actually, of all things, foregrounds and their removal, because that's the name of the game. This is the famous cosmic sandwich of 1998, showing that all of this collapses on to make some complex pattern, but there's frequency dependence in each of the patterns, so you can unravel it by that at some level, and the question is what level? Because this is sort of one of the great goals. These are the Sinyaev-Zeldovich type effects with these sort of sourcey patterns, etc. Can I go backwards? Okay, here it is. Yeah, okay. So, August to June 2010 delivered the data that was used to make all sky 9 frequency maps, and also by using a separation of components method, the maps minus the CMB. Now you say, why are you throwing out the CMB? It's because we aren't ready to deliver that information. So this is what was delivered to the consortium on August the 2nd, 2010. This is the nature of the maps as we go through the low-frequency instrument and the increasing frequencies of the high frequency instrument. And of course, you know, you get dust picking up here. Here we have the synchrotron, and this is the way the sky looks if you take away the CMB. And then what you're trying to do is to figure out what all these little bits are. Okay, I will not tell you about the methods that are used, but there has been a remarkable amount of work on exactly how you're going to do this component separation. There will be a lot more work on how to do the component separation because that's the name of the game. If you're going to go for the cosmological signal, you have to do it with exquisite precision.
Is that the scan strategy showing up in those the third, fourth, and fifth map?
Partly that.
Why does it only show up in three maps?
It's because the noise here is a little higher.
So these are subtracted maps. CMB is completely dominated. You wouldn't see this if CMB was in there, right? This is 100 gigahertz. That's sort of, you know, essentially a minimum of the ranges of the foregrounds, one coming from the dusty side and one coming from the synchrotron side. The early release compact source catalog. Greater than 90% reliability, blah, 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 blah. Huge number, 15,000, I said. A lot of them in the galaxy, a lot of them extragalactic. This is the LMC. So there's a lot of information to play with within these catalogs. Okay, take care and all that stuff. There is a class of objects that led to a second catalog called the early release compact core catalog that involves clumpy regions within the Milky Way that are identified by various frequency methods, and they correspond to what turns out, I'm sure you can recognize that this is cold dust, 7 to 17 degrees Kelvin, 915 of those, but they did a much more complete analysis in which they got 10,000, which was going beyond what was actually released in the early release compact core. And so there were obviously papers analyzing this. And what are these objects? These objects are precursors of what will ultimately become stars, and they go up to about 10 to the fifth times the mass of the sun. So you can see that this is a tremendous treasure trove for people interested in such things, even though it is not cosmological. The cold clumps, or cold cores, they tend to be in groups and filaments, and they exist on the edges of loops that are associated with, you know, the very, very dynamic interstellar medium. And so there is a lot of interesting information about how stars ultimately will form with these as great tracers. Okay, I was going to go back to 1987 to talk about what was on the table way back then before any of this game really started. And many of the things were on the table. We needed to know the answer. We needed to know something about radio sources. We thought that one could do ambient or blank field thermal Sinyaev-Zel'dovich effect, and we're making the earliest forecasts for that. Dusty galaxies were on our table, in particular, all aspects of the clustering of that. Energy injection, big issue. ISM wasn't even, IGM was an issue. And what did we get at this meeting? Well, we got a lot of information on all of this, not just from Planck, but from ACT and SBT and WMAP. And the basic thing is that there's a model that exists. This guy was actually operating with those sorts of models way back in 87 and continually refining them. And the source counts are sort of on fairly reasonable foundation with some interesting things at high frequency. The ambient thermal Sinyaev-Zel'dovich effect, of course, you've heard about ACT. SBT, similar story, but Planck, and I'll show you that in a moment. That's something near and dear to us at CETUS, so I'll say a bit more about that. Dusty galaxies. Planck made a very significant detection and report of the cosmic infrared background from dusty galaxies, but there has been information from ACT and SBT, Amir Hajian and the actors in the blasters did this great ACT cross-blast correlation and also shed light on this. In fact, an agreement. And Herschel also came up with something. So I'm going to now sort of step through a list of things. And I'm going to start with the Sinyaev-Zeldovich. I'll spend a bit of time on that and then race as fast as I can through the ISM. I'm just kidding. I can't try. I probably will have to. So I've told you, 189 clusters, SZ scaling relations that have been determined for what is the strength of Sinyaev-Zeldovich emission or upscattering compared with masses and other information as determined from X-ray clusters. It seems in broad brushstroke they're in pretty good agreement. Something for aficionados. But for optical clusters, there is a puzzle. And so I'll just give you a bit of information on that. We don't know what the cause is. It's under a lot of attention right now, including with us. All right. I'm going to go back in time, but I think we've heard enough about the Sinyaev-Zeldovich. In the press release, there was this nice little GIF file that was done to show what happens as you move through the intensity spectrum that is quite unique as predicted for the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect, and it shows you the different bands the different bands as you move through it, and how by using all of that information together for that unique shape that you're picking out in terms of a frequency template, you would be able to draw from the data much more than you would if you were looking at individual frequencies. And so sure enough, that is the case. Okay, and I'll just go to the next one. But at the same time as this was put out, there were also new Sinyaev-Zeldovich blind detections reported by both ACT and SBT. Their numbers come up to about 50 each. And those numbers are going to go up substantially as well. So the number of so this science is really quite in a remarkable state right now in terms of Fermat and the number of clusters seen. Okay, well, what do I want to say about this? I was going to say a little bit of detail about how you actually do the detection of the clusters. Take it as read that the best job that can be done was done for the data as it is, and it's pretty remarkable with a lot of robustness testing. So I won't go through more than that sort of thing. But now I'm going to go over to two issues. One is that Planck was really lucky because XMM Newton gave a lot of director time, discretionary time, to Planck to follow up on clusters that it had seen of a sufficient signal-to-noise ratio. And so there was this major project to look at, in particular, the new things that Planck had seen on the sky that nobody had seen before. And there were about 25 such targets. 21 were confirmed within this XMM Newton. It's a way of trying to decide how robust what Planck sees is. Recall that the Planck beams are not that tiny. So of that grouping, 17 single clusters were found and confirmed with XMM Newton, and they're almost all disturbed. So these new things that are picked up are things that are maybe in merge or some other type of action, which is not an unreasonable thing. Lots of clusters are in such a state. They aren't as pristine as I think people had hoped. there were two double systems and two sort of super clusters, triple systems. This was a press release given in September that's associated with one of these XMM Newtons. This is the Planck image, and this is X-ray contours over it from XMM Newton. And so what is a blob from the Planckian perspective, because of the resolution, turns out to have broken into three clusters as part of a supercluster in XMM Newton. So that's just a lesson that one must understand, that if you're trying to understand in detail what are you going to do with these counts, you have to understand that, in fact, they aren't necessarily all single clusters, and that follow-up with higher resolution is absolutely essential in this game. Okay, the other major piece of news that came out was, in fact, a puzzle. And the puzzle was that if you took a bunch of optical galaxies, brightest cluster galaxies, huge sample, 13,000 of these in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and you essentially cross-correlate it with this frequency matching for Planck, then you find that if you rank order these cluster galaxies in terms of the richness around them, which is telling you essentially how big the cluster is at an optical level anyway, and you go down and down and down, what you find is that there's a correlation between the strength of the Sinyaev-Zaldovich signal, which is essentially a measure of the thermal energy of the cluster, and this richness. And it's a really pretty good line, and the error bars, the remarkable thing about this is how small they are for Planck. Nothing like having a lot of statistics. The other thing is that it turns out that this lowest bin is about 5 times 10 to the 13th solar masses. So that's really essentially invading into the group region. Never been done before with Sinyaev-Zaldovich. So it's a unique result. But then here is the puzzle. The puzzle is that there is an attempt to try and calibrate the richness in terms of the number of galaxies within this entity to the mass. And what was done was to use lensing. This was not done by Planck. This was done by another group using the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And if you do that, you find that your masses are high. And so it appears that there is a puzzle because of a discrepancy in the agreement. So the first thing you say is, well, these optical guys don't know what they're doing when they're doing the lensing. Well, of course they know what they're doing. So, but the question is, are there systematic effects that can explain this? We don't know the answer of what can be causing this yet. That's a big deal. But there's a really curious thing that happens. If you just take a bunch of the clusters that have actually been seen in the X-ray before, and you do exactly the same exercise, that you find that, in fact, it's essentially bang on. So one possibility is that the things that are picked up under the optical are also picking up things that are not really sort of the centrally condensed X-ray things. This is a big puzzle. We don't know the answer. We're trying to explore it at CETA, but lots of other people are exploring it as well. So it's an interesting puzzle. And just to add to that,
richness was calibrated for optical for max precision.
Well, it was a, I think, a stack lensing analysis.
A stack lensing.
Yeah, and it turned out that a few years before the one that gives this was done, there was another paper that tried to do the same thing. And if you use those values, it's less. But this is considered to be the state of the art right now in terms of that game. So just to say, Sudeep alluded to this, that there is a paper by ACT that appeared one day before the papers or so by Planck, showed essentially the same effect, but using somewhat different techniques, a different sample and all of that, and not as much statistics as you can get from an all-sky survey. So there weren't nearly as many objects. But it's also, in this thing, this is M, so the effect of N is, it's actually the same trend as this. And there's also a bit of a difference between the different ways the masses were determined here. One of them was through the lensing, what does correspond to this
bit of data. In any case, the bottom line is that there are two experiments that are seeing roughly the same thing, and so it has to be understood. Okay, I can say some more. Anyway, these crosses and blue things are the set of clusters that have been seen in the Sinai of Zeldovich, at least before the most recent release of Acton SPT, as not released, but it was as described at the meeting. And this is what Planck did for it, all these red guys. So it's a pretty impressive addition to the Sinai of Zeldovich, and some of them are things we know and love. Do I really want to, how much time have I got? Right. Yeah, I do, because Sinai Zeldovich, as we all know, is much more interesting than the ISM. No, I'm just kidding. I will have my little ISM punchline at the end. But I think that this is kind of fun. This was the state of the strength of the Sinai Zeldovich against the mass that we had before the Planck release. This was the SPT data, and this was some X-ray data, and these things go up, and we had a theoretical model from simulations that wasn't quite in agreement. This is what happened when you add some of the Planck information. Again, it's a scatter around these lines, but there are a number of orders of magnitude on the lines. It doesn't look too bad, and in fact, it is not too bad. However, one of the most important things, I won't say it, I'll just say it in words, is that our simulations are showing that these kinds of objects, especially when you're picking up these Sinai Zeldovich strengths, are not in full hydrostatic equilibrium with thermal content. They have a bulk, sort of turbulent flow within the media that must be taken into account, and that causes corrections to all of the data to move in a direction which actually aids things quite a bit, and so that the final version draws the lines of the observers together with our theoretical line, and things sort of cluster around it. And that's one aspect. That looks okay. But then there's the issue of what about this optical total SZ integrated measure? What about that? We don't know the answer. We've checked a lot of things, and we've got a lot of sort of 20% effects. Maybe that's part of the story, but it still has to be unraveled, and I believe that it will be a big topic of conversation in the KITP cluster conference when we get there in March. Okay, resolution is everything. Okay, can we do fundamental physics with the cluster system? No idea, but there's a lot of gastrophysics. Okay, the CIB, I mentioned it already, and it's been nicely detected in Planck. Oops. You can show power. See, it's trying to avoid that. There it is. See it? Anyway, you don't want to look at this in detail. It's the power spectra. It's all consistent with galaxy-galaxy clustering with a bias factor. And the question is, how well does it all hang together? And it seems to hang together with all of the different ways that this has been observed now. There was this big step by Planck, small error bars once again, intimately involving data that was taken associated with Marc Antoine and Peter Martin in order to actually unravel this. Huge detections of power spectra. This is not an L squared, it's an L, which tells you that the galaxy-galaxy correlation is basically what you expect. But you want to go to higher resolution, and all of these things delivered information to actually more or less confirm it, with Herschel delivering information that was a bit higher, still a puzzle, not understood. So now you can actually make images, maps, of what the CIB looks like. Well, it's not that informative, but it's pretty neat that you can actually do that by separating out all of the other stuff. Spinning dust. Do you want to hear about spinning? Probably not, right? It's a foreground of great relevance to us. We have to get rid of it, and it was a big development with Planck. So I'm going to work my way down the list and say a pithy word or two about these things. Spinning dust. Nice. Wow. the radio sources and as well the infrared sources, I already said that it's essentially roughly as expected, new information, not completely overturning our conception, but the infrared sources in nearby galaxies has a cold component which couldn't have been seen before. Typically, when usually referred to the dust being about 30 degrees, now 20 degrees. Okay, now I have to say something about the ISM because Marc Antoine says I must say something. No, he doesn't. So there is a huge amount of information that's been drawn about galactic dust from the data, mostly using templates from H1, CO. It's all a fantastic mix, nice set of methods. And so you get maps, all sky maps in the Milky Way of things like dust emission measures. You see what's called dark gas, which has got nothing to do with dark matter or dark energy. It's just stuff that isn't correlated with H1 or CO, so it serves an unfortunate name. It's probably associated with molecular hydrogen. So all sky stuff for the ISM in our galaxy. You should marvel, but don't pay too much attention to it because it's not cosmological. That hasn't been addressed yet at the precision we want to, so there's nothing that's been said about that. But to the extent it's there, it's there. What is its source? That's the issue. And Planck is unique in the ability, well, maybe not unique, maybe WMAP-9 can help on this, but the polarization aspect can really be looked at with high precision with Planck, and that's will be done. Okay, there was a lot of neat Herschel stuff, and what I actually quite liked is the methods that are now being used in ISM. Some of them have been borrowed from cosmology type things, and so it's sort of much the same language, but a much more complex system where turbulence simulations are being tried to cross-talk with the very complex information that one's obtaining in these galaxy maps that have been pulled out by the component separations that have been done. And so that's the whole story of what was released. And so what I ended that meeting on was everything is in the eye of the beholder. We required that the Planck papers that were going to come out, there was a meeting in Cambridge where the people that were making proponents of, why don't we put out a paper on this? They were asked to say, what is the wow factor of this paper? Well, as you might guess, wow is in the eye of the beholder. So some people get gastrointestinal disorders associated with gastrophysical complications, in particular in the intergalactic medium, and you might even think that that's true if you look at attempts to think of what interstellar dust is really like. These are actually interplanetary dust, things a lot bigger than interstellar dust, but you can just see it's soot. But you might also say it's a gourmand's paradise in this veil here. And in Paris, we like to think was the gourmand's paradise, certainly. And then the other thing that is an ongoing issue, how do you draw out the beauty in this complex information? How do you actually encode things? You know, you do things like power spectrum and all of that, but what is the best way to encode this complexity? And that's a subject that will go on for a very long time, perhaps in association with relating to turbulent simulations. So what I was going to do was to show you what the cosmology results are going to look like, but I'm not going to. Our goals are R, tensor to scalar ratio. Our goal is non-Gaussianity. Our goal is subdominant phenomenon. Our goal is finding the... I mean, it's an unfortunate situation. Well, anyway. So there's ambition associated with this. You can see that combining plank with an ACT pole is an even bigger lever arm, helps you with the removable components as well. And so the prospects are good that we are going to understand the experiment with enough precision to be able to go after these questions. But we are not there. The big push right now that we've got first results out on the temperature maps, albeit not with the CMB, is to try and make sure that we fully understand every systematic associated with the polarization measurement, which may turn out to be the greatest legacy of Planck at all, the polarization maps that it comes up with, not just for what's there primordially, but as well for a unique picture for the interstellar medium in terms of what it's like in polarization. So the prospects, Planck is going to keep us very busy. The unfortunate thing is that, you know, our mouths have to be sealed. We wrote a contract by slicing our... and so it is only when we get a delivery of data like that that we really get to tell you what's going on. But I hope that by looking under the hood here and seeing what's going on, you will see that Planck is really a remarkable mission, which is living up to what our great hopes were. Thank you.